Enoch was the seventh from Adam. That means he was a representative of the seventh generation from Adam. And when we look at the generations from Adam, it seems that they had gone progressively from bad to worse. And there in the middle of this degenerating, deteriorating culture was this bright and shining light called Enoch. Enoch had this testimony. Presumably the testimony came from God, but also, I believe, it must have been recognized by his contemporaries. There was a man who was different. And the difference was that he walked with God. The question, of course, that we ask ourselves is, well, how do you do that? And when we look at the exposition of Enoch's life and that of many other of the ancients, we find that he, Enoch, and these other people operated on the principle of faith. There was a fundamentally simple principle behind their lives. They operated on the basis of faith. Nothing unusual about that, for the very simple reason that every human being is wired up to dependence. Every human being is limited in their understanding, and there are certain things that they cannot empirically verify. Therefore, they accept them on the basis of faith. Every human being looks forward to that which he cannot necessarily see, but he hopes that it was there. That's how we operate. Everybody operates by faith, but the key to faith is the object of faith. For it is possible to have tremendous faith in that which is unworthy of the faith, and this will leave you in terrible, terrible problems. On the other hand, you can have very, very slight faith in that which is utterly faithful and find yourself perfectly secured. It's not the volume of faith that's important at first. It is the object of faith. Well, we explore a little further into this remarkable man who stood out in his generation because he lived by faith. It was not because he lived by faith that it was different. It was because his faith was focused on God. And that faith had specific details to it. He, first of all, by faith, believed that God is. Then he believed that the God who is not just a metaphysical force, a transcendent entity, but that this transcendent one, this overarching one, was actually the one responsible intentionally and intelligently for creating all that exists, including Enoch. So when a person believes that there is a God and believes that that God is the creator of all things, that begins to formulate the direction of that person's life, because they begin to realize that they were created intentionally for an intelligent purpose. And the smart person will say, the one thing I have to find out is, why and how was I made in order that I might be that for which I was created? It's summarized up in the wonderful words of the Apostle Paul. For from him and through him and to him are all things. Enoch, in some way, we don't know the extent of his understanding. We know that he only understood a fraction of what we are privileged to know, because we live in the era of Christ. But what we do know is that in some way, he had concluded that God was the creator of all things, and that fashioned the way he looked at his life. But now we begin to realize that Enoch's faith goes a step further, for he not only believes that he is the transcendent entity, but we discover that he is the reason for all things and that he is the possessor of all things. That it could be that he was just the reason for all things and then had lost interest and gone off and done something else. But now Enoch's faith discovers that he is a God who welcomes individuals to come into a relationship with him. And so Enoch does the obvious thing. because he believes that God is, and because he believes that God has created and believes that God is approachable, he approaches him. And in approaching him, this is what he discovers. He discovers that this God actually is so intimately concerned with individuals whom he created that he rewards them. He blesses them. He lavishes grace upon them. And not only that, this God who lavishes grace upon those who come to him earnestly and sincerely seeking him is the one who has promised that he will bring human history to its glorious consummation. And so this person who lives by faith in this God not only can look back and see a reason for his existence, not only can look into his life at any given moment and see grace abundant for all the vicissitudes of life, but he can look forward and know how the story ends. And he knows that it is possible to live in a declining culture, in a disintegrating society, with equanimity, with inner calm, with utmost confidence. He lives by faith. That's our man. Now, the interesting thing about it is this, that it says, unless you live like that, there's no way you can please God. Unless you live like that, there's no way you can please God. Well, that makes sense. Can you imagine God being sitting up there in heaven saying, I'm absolutely thrilled with those people who've determined without any basis for their belief, they have determined I do not exist. Wow, that's wonderful. He does not like that. Do you think God is really thrilled with people who say, well, I don't believe that God is the intentional, intelligent creator of all things, including me, and the most pressing thing that I can do is find out why and how he made me in order that I might be what I'm intended to be? Do you think he's impressed by people who say, that's a lot of nonsense? That's a lot of nonsense. Do you think that God is pleased with people who say, I don't need the grace of God, I am self-sufficient? I can go it alone. I'll do it myself. Do you think that pleases him? Do you think that people who simply say, this world of ours is meaningless, this universe is pointless, it started with an accident, it continues with a series of accidents, and in the end, it will end with a cataclysmic accident, and everything will dissolve into nothingness. Do you think that pleases him? Well, of course not. Of course not. Unless we begin to discover the faith of a man like Enoch, we've got to come to terms with the fact that however pleased with us people might be, how many accolades they may shower upon us, however highly they may eulogize us when we, like Enoch, was not, God will be singularly unpleased. Remember hearing the story of the young, brilliant musician who gave a concert at Carnegie Hall. And at the end of his concert there, he was given a standing ovation. And he walked off into the wings of the stage, and the stage manager said, go back on and give them an encore. He said, no. He said, no, they're crying for you, they're shouting for you, they're screaming for you, they're clapping and cheering for you. He said, I'm not going. He said that everybody was standing. And the young pianist said, there was one man wasn't. There was one man wasn't. I'm not going back on. He said, what is it for one man? He said, that one man was my teacher. I'm not going back on. You can have the whole of Carnegie Hall praising you to the sky if the man who knows you, the man who made you, is not applauding. You don't go back on. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. These are searching words. But what are we talking about? We're talking about walking with God for the long haul. It's very interesting to notice what it says in the immediate context of Hebrews 11 concerning the people to whom the epistle to the Hebrews is written. Let me read it for you at the end of chapter 10, verse 32. Remember those earlier days after you had received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property, because you knew that you yourself had better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere, so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, quote, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. If he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed. We are of those who believe and are being saved. We are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed. We are of those who believe and are being saved. So what is the writer to the Hebrews saying as he begins to outline these men of faith? What he's saying is this. First of all, faith perseveres. Faith perseveres. What does it persevere in? What does it persevere through? Well, it says here in verse 32 of chapter 10, you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Is there a great contest going on in the world today? Let me just remind you, in case you're not sure. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He evaluated everything that he had created and pronounced it excellent. Excellent. He then handed over what he had created to the pinnacle of the created order called humanity. And in handing it over to humanity, he made them his agents. And he said that they were to enjoy it, and they were to subdue it, and they were to order it according to the design of the intelligent, intentional God who made it all. He did, however, remind them that the only way they could do that would be if they lived in an attitude of trusting, loving obedience to God. The problem, of course, that arose very, very quickly was that they didn't particularly want to trust him, and they certainly didn't want to obey him. And so what they actually did was renege on their commitment. And when they were given the opportunity to take things into their own hand, because they were tempted to believe that they could do it better than God, and they could have a better experience without God, and that this was really what was going to satisfy them, when they began to think in those terms, they eventually had the opportunity not only to renege on their promise, but to go into an attitude of outright rebellion, disobedience rather than obedience, distrust rather than trust, faithlessness rather than faith. And you know what they did? They handed over their agency to the enemy of God. And that is why this world that you and I inhabit right at this moment, according to Scripture, lies in the wicked one. It was traded. It was traded. Now, don't be under any illusions about this world in which we live. I'm fully aware of the fact that it is, in parts, beautiful. I'm well aware of the fact it is absolutely breathtaking in places. And Jill and I have had the privilege of being on every continent, and I think we've seen some of the most beautiful, magnificent things there are to see in this world of ours. But the truth of the matter is this. This world that was created by God for God was handed over to the agency of humanity, was traded for self-determination and self-sufficiency, and as a result, the whole world lies in the wicked one, the enemy of God and his purposes. Now, God is not going to take that lying down, and he said, that's my world, and I want it back. Son, go get it. And that's the conflict you and I live in. Now, if we have taken the step of determining that the right way to live is by faith in the God of our and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, then the simple fact of the matter is this. We have taken sides in this grand cosmic conflict. Make no mistake about it. We have taken sides in this grand cosmic conflict. And having taken sides in this grand cosmic conflict, you and I are in a state of war. You and I are in a state of war. One of the questions that Jill and I ask most frequently as we travel and try to minister to leaders in the developing world as well as in the developed world or developing world, one of the most frequently asked questions is this: how do we balance ministry and family? How do we balance ministry and family? This is a whole new other subject. I mustn't get off on it. And very, very often, that question will be related to the fact that during the days that our children were growing up, my ministry called me away from home for month after month after month after month. And we came in those days under heavy criticism. We still do to this day. This doesn't bother us particularly for two reasons. Number one, God called us, therefore he equips you for it. And our kids didn't seem to take any harm whatsoever. In fact, if they'd had the doubtful privilege of my constant attention, I think they'd have turned out a whole lot worse than they did. One of the things that I try to explain to these people who object to me being an absentee father was this. You have to remember that Jill and I were born in wartime England. And being born in wartime England, there was nothing unusual for men who were in a war to be called away from their families and to be gone for a long time. I had friends who never met their fathers until they were 4 years old, because their fathers were sent overseas shortly after their mothers became pregnant with this child. And they were gone for years. The regiment of the city where I grew up was called the Border Regiment. All the men who weren't drafted into other battalions went automatically into the Border Regiment. The Border Regiment was shipped out to the Far East on a troop ship that docked in Singapore just as Singapore surrendered to the Japanese. So the whole of the Border Regiment were marched off the ship straight into the Japanese camps. Hundreds of the men from my town never returned. Those who did return, returned deeply scarred. And most of them were gone for at least 4 years. That's where I grew up. That was normative. So people who grow up in warfare have a slightly different view of life than people who have not lived through a war, who have not been subjected to the deprivations of it. I believe that if we were failing in our balancing of marriage and ministry in those days, we could be criticized for sacrificing family on the altar of ministry. I believe the problem today is the reverse. We're in danger of sacrificing ministry on the altar of family. And the fundamental reason for it is this. We have overlooked the simple fact we are in a war. Enoch certainly knew he was. He knew he was. And he knew that if he was going to make it in that warfare, in that conflict, then he was going to need all the resources that he could possibly draw upon, and he knew where to find them. For he believed that God is. And he believed that coming to him, because he was approachable, God was a rewarder of all who diligently sought him. And Enoch walked with God right in the midst of the conflict. Sisters and brothers, that's our calling. That's where it's at. That is the world in which we live. Read on. Verse 32. I'm in Hebrews chapter 10. I have no idea where I left you. Hebrews 10:32. Remember those earlier days, after you had received the light, when you stood your ground in a great context. This, now look what he says. In the face of suffering. In the face of suffering. Do you think the people to whom Hebrews was addressed were suffering? Sure. What does it say? Well, it says sometimes they were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. That hurts, doesn't it? At other times, they intentionally took their stand against people who were being so treated. In other words, they themselves weren't being persecuted, but they went alongside and they took the burden of those who were going through persecution. They didn't turn their faces the other way. They didn't close a blind eye to what was going on. They took their stand with them. Not only that, there were some people that they recognized were in prison. And what did they do? They sympathized with them. They got alongside those people. And what else did they do? When their property was confiscated, they didn't think it was the end of the world because they were not fundamentally materialists. They were not fundamentally naturalists. They were not fundamentally locked into the temporal. These people were living by faith. And living by faith, they were able to stand firm in the midst of conflict, and they were able to progress in the midst of vicissitudes of life. And that's our calling. That's our calling. And that was precisely what they did. Helmut Thielicke, the great German theologian, on one occasion said, "The Western Church has no adequate theology of suffering." The Western Church has no adequate theology of suffering. Now, he could talk because he was a pastor during the Second World War in Nazi-controlled Germany. He ministered in a large church in Stuttgart, Germany, that was bombed repeatedly during the Second World War, and he spent most days in between Sundays not only preparing his sermons, but burying his congregation. And the building itself was progressively destroyed. He knew what he was talking about when he talked about suffering. He knew what he was talking about when he ministered to people who were suffering. They suffered dreadfully in those days. When somebody like Thielicke says the Western Church has no adequate theology of suffering, what is he saying? What he's saying basically is this, that when we suffer, there is a natural tendency for us in the West to believe that something has gone fundamentally wrong. This ought not to be happening to me. One of the great privileges that Jill and I have in traveling in many parts of the world is that we spend a lot of time in the East. I often joke when people say to us, why do you still travel at your age? I say, well, one reason is we go to the Orient where old age is still respected. But it's not a case of just old age is respected. They have an entirely different attitude to suffering. In the West, the attitude to suffering is fundamentally this. Oh God, I'm hurting. Oh God, I'm suffering. Please get this off my back. In the East, the attitude is totally different. Oh God, I'm hurting. Oh God, I'm suffering. please strengthen my back. Please strengthen my back. The Apostle Paul, I've often thought about this. The Apostle Paul, when he was called to Jesus and when he was called at the same time to ministry, and God, who commanded light to shine into darkness, commanded the truth of the gospel should shine into the benighted heart of Saul of Tarsus, what did he do? Well, he was struck blind. He went into a house on Straight Street in the middle of Damascus. A little man called Ananias was sent to pray for him. You remember the story? Little old Ananias went. That was a gutsy thing to do. He knew why Saul of Tarsus had come to town. It was to round up people like Ananias and either kill them or imprison them. God said, go to Saul of Tarsus. Lay your hands on him. I can imagine God saying, no, Ananias, not round his throat, on his head. Now pray for him. And show him, and listen to this, and show him what great things he must suffer for me. Why? Why is he being called right from the very beginning to recognize that he will suffer if he identifies with the name and cause of Christ? And the answer is very simply this. The only God that we have to worship is a suffering God. The only gospel that we have to preach is a cross-based gospel. The only discipleship that we know is a discipleship that follows Jesus and takes up his cross and keeps on following. So it's perfectly normative to recognize that, as Peter says to his contemporaries when they are facing suffering, don't think that something abnormal is happening to you. It's not abnormal. It's perfectly normal because we're fallen people living in a fallen world that has created a fallen culture, and you're not immune and you're not exempt. And it's going to be tough and it's going to be hard, and you're in the middle of a conflict. Paul's attitude to suffering was remarkable. Paul's attitude to suffering, probably based on the fact that he was called in the first place to suffer for Christ. But his attitude to suffering was this: we are exceeding joyful in the midst of all our tribulations. We are exceeding joyful in the midst of all our tribulations. What? Is this guy a masochist? Does he get his kicks out of suffering? No. He fully understands that if you identify with a suffering God, if you identify with a gospel based on the cross, if you've chosen to become a disciple of Jesus predicated on taking up your own cross, then you recognize not only that that which you are being called to operate in is perfectly normal, but you also know that if God calls, he equips, and you live by faith in the midst of suffering. Faith in what? That's the key. Faith in what? Faith, first of all, in the fact that God is not out of control. Secondly, faith in the fact that God, who is not out of control, has not lost interest in you. Thirdly, faith in the fact that the God who is still in control and has not lost interest in you will make available to you all the grace that is necessary for you to live well in the circumstances through which you pass. Fourthly, faith in the fact that God, who will give you grace to live well in the situation, is the one who specializes in bringing beauty out of ashes, who brings dancing out of mourning, who gets hold of the most wretched circumstances and brings out of them something of beauty that would never have happened otherwise. And faith in the fact that God, in the end, will take you to be with himself in an eternal environment, an infinite environment, for which this life down here is a very, 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 very brief, inadequate prelude. He will take you to an eternal, infinite environment, characterized by righteousness, in a new heaven, a new earth that is spelled out in one word, glory. And you will inhabit a glorified body as ideally suited to your glorified environment, as your creaking old body, not yours, mine, our creaking old bodies are ideally suited to this fallen environment. And in the midst of suffering, we walk by faith. We walk by faith. This is what the writer to the Hebrews is impressing upon some Hebrew believers who are considering quitting, giving up, running out of gas, simply because their circumstances are so overwhelming them that they're losing sight of the God who transcends circumstance. And they are simply reacting to and responding to circumstances rather than standing firm in faith on the God of all comfort. Let me wrap this up. Isn't that a lovely expression? Let me wrap this up. I've stopped saying finally. And I'll tell you why. Because my brother, who's a preacher, said to me one day about our dad, who's a preacher, have you noticed that dad sometimes says finally and sometimes he says lastly? I said, yes, I have noticed that. He said, have you also noticed that when he says finally, he finishes, but when he says lastly, he lasts? So, lastly, finally. All right, finally, let's be quite specific about what we're talking about in this faith life in the midst of conflict, this faith life in the midst of suffering, this faith life that sometimes begins to drain out of us, this faith life that sometimes becomes so discouraged that we almost feel like giving up. What exactly is this faith all about? Let me give you an example here. When Jill and I realized that we were invited to come down here to North Carolina and we lived in Wisconsin, we really didn't want to walk. Jill didn't want to come on her bicycle. And we didn't particularly want to drive. And then somebody very kindly told us about an airplane. And we were fascinated when they told us about airplanes. And they said that there were machines that actually you can get inside and they will fly at an enormous rate of knots and they will land you where you want to go most of the time. They said they give you execrable food on it. They don't give any now. They put you in seats that require you to put your feet in your pockets. But if you do that, you'll be perfectly comfortable. And they will be totally overcrowded and there'll be nowhere for you to put your baggage, so you have to pay $20 a crack for the privilege of having them take your bags for you. But they say, but it works very well. Well, we were intrigued by this. We explored it. We got the information on it. We went down to the airport. We checked. There was a flight coming down here. We found out what time it left. And we got all this information. And we came to a conclusion that what we were being told equated to reality. Now, when something equates to reality, that's another way of saying it's true. It's true. And we came to the conclusion that what we had been told was true. And we never moved an inch. But then something very interesting happened. The more we thought about it, the more we thought, we really don't want to walk. and we really don't want to cycle, and we really don't want to drive, and there's something very appealing about this idea of flying. And something very interesting was happening now. We were getting beyond a belief that says, I believe that something is true. But now we were believing that which was true was desirable. And something was happening. You see, the first dimension of faith was what we call cognitive. Cognitive. We believe that something is true. But the second dimension of faith is what we call emotive. That means I not only have grasped what I believe equates to reality, that is, it is true, I am now moved by it. This knowledge affects me. It is affective. It is emotive faith. Now, here's the problem. Many, many people never get beyond the cognitive. They believe that something is true. That's it. Doesn't make any difference. I remember a friend of ours had a small boy. And one Sunday morning, he was playing in front of the fire in England, and the Anglican service came on the radio. And during the course of the Anglican service, they were reciting, of course, as part of their liturgy, the Apostles' Creed. And they did it. Some of the churches in the Anglican Communion will do it sort of in a chant mode. And so while this little kid was playing on the hearth in front of the fire with his cars, paying apparently no attention to the radio that was going on with this service, suddenly the vicar over the radio says, I believe in God. And this little kid playing with his cars continued playing with his cars, and he said, so do I. So do I. And carried on playing with his cars. And that's cognitive belief. I believe that something is true. Doesn't make any difference. I just continue playing with my cars. I just continue living my life. But I believe it's true. I'm a believer. Cognitive belief will not allow you to stand your ground in the great contest. Cognitive belief will not allow you to progress in the face of suffering. Cognitive belief on its own will not allow you to take the despoiling of your material possessions joyfully, because you know that you have possessions of eternal value. Cognitive belief won't help you very much there. What is needed, you see, is for cognitive to become affective, where what you believe affects you deeply. And sometimes, as we looked at the aeroplane, we were drawn to the attraction of flying rather than the other modes of transport. So when we begin to look at what we believe about God is and God creates, etc., 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 genuine faith not only gives an academic nod to these things, genuine faith now begins to be moved by them. And sometimes we can be moved by being attracted to them, and sometimes we can be moved by being repelled from them. What we believe about our world, which equates to reality, and Scripture underlines this, repels us. What we learn about God attracts us. When we learn that God will come with his holy angels and he will separate the godly from the ungodly in the final assize, that can move us with holy fear and reverential awe. But if we simply say, I believe in God, and carry on playing with our toys, that's not the kind of faith that is going to allow you to stand firm in the face of sufferings, to hold your ground in the great context. It needs to be cognitive. It needs to be affective. So we stood at Milwaukee Airport. I believed fervently that that plane was a better way of going than bicycling. I was drawn and attracted to this thing called flying. And we still didn't move an inch. We still did not move an inch. And then a very nice young lady came up, tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, "Would you take your mother?" I said, "That's my wife." She said, "No, I'm sorry, that slipped out. That was a Freudian slip, I think. Yes, but I just wanted to see if you're listening." And that's an ideal way to find out. Okay. She tapped us on the shoulder, and she said, "The plane is about to leave. You need to get on board." And I said, "I believe that. I believe it." She said, "No, you need to get on board." I said, "I find that very attractive. I'm drawn to it." She said, "Sir, you need to get on board." Oh, and it dawned on me. For real faith, there has to be cognitive, then there has to be affective, and then there has to be evaluative dimension. And evaluative dimension brings me to the point of saying, basically, you believe that this particular piece of information equates to reality. You are now drawn and attracted to it deeply. Now, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? And that's where we come unglued. For very, very often, we'll find ourselves in the great contest, and we have a technical belief about certain things. Not only that, we are certainly drawn to many aspects of this belief because we know deep down in our hearts that's the right way to go. But when we look at what's entailed and what's involved, we say no. No. But you see, without faith, without cognitive, affective, evaluative faith, you can't please God. Makes sense, doesn't it? Because what you're really saying is, "I believe all this about God, but I'm not going to put it into operation when push comes to shove." So where does this leave us? It leaves us in a very simple position of saying, all right, is my life governed by my circumstances, or is my life governed by faith? And then the question is, if it is governed by faith, faith in what? And then the question is, what kind of faith? Is it cognitive, affective, and evaluative? And then the next question is this, and how does that show? Am I standing my ground in the great conflict? Am I holding my position in the face of suffering? Do I see that which is material and temporal as being infinitely inferior to that which is spiritual and eternal? And therefore, I can actually take the spoiling of temporal, material things quite cheerfully, because I know whom I have believed. And I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed to him until that day. This is what our world needs. Some people who will be the Enoch people of the 21st century.